This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician. Giddy hit Austin. My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Just want to do things my own way, you know.
Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Your old friend Phil Pritchett is here with you. Be at ease. Be filled with a sense of joy that we're going to share this time together here right now from Trinidad World Recording Studios, my beautiful studio here in beautiful Fort Worth, Texas. I hope everyone around the globe is enjoying all things we do here at Trinidad, from the podcast to the live record, the studio records, producing things, anything and everything we can do, creating music for films, and all things that you enjoy. We try to provide it for you here, folks. You still thinking about making that record, even if you've never recorded in your life or finished a song? Call me, 817-733-5256, or email me, phil@philpritchett.com. Say, Phil, I need to make a record. Or, Phil, can you and the band come play at my party? We're doing this big thing we do every year. Or just a small thing in the backyard. We love it, man. Love the private party. Love playing for the fans. So give us a shout, man. Give us a shout. Pardon me, I'm settling in the chair here. Settling in because I want to talk to you about something very near and dear to my heart. Man, we had our friend John Reynolds, a movie man from across the hall. He was on a couple weeks ago, back before the summer break, but we're back in full swing now. Back in full swing. Well, I always chide John. I'm looking for answers when John's on the show. He's a huge movie buff, and he keeps up with modern movies a lot more than myself. But he shares my views as far as, films today. We've talked about it many times on the show that recently it has become apparent that people in Hollywood who put up the money to make movies have concluded one thing, and that is the only people who go see movies are 11-year-old boys. Therefore, every movie we have is the Hulk, it is Spider-Man, it is Batman, it is Avengers, it is Iron Man, and all things in between, sequels of everything. Every quote-unquote new movie is, the Brady Bunch again, or they're just remaking TV shows into movies, and there's just no original ideas. I say it all the time, you know, when I'll see Dances with Wolves or something on AMC, or so I don't know, just something not too old, maybe 15 years old, And I always ponder. I'm like, man, are they even trying to make movies like this anymore? And the answer seems to be, without question, no. They're not looking for epic, big-budget movies to make, a la Titanic or something like that. Now, you had, like, Avatar, but that was mostly that was a huge deal, but it was mostly a CGI kind of deal. Yeah, really more akin to, like, Avengers or something rather than Titanic. So that's just kind of the way it is, right? I mean, that's the market for the movies. And you don't even know who makes these movies. You know guys' names. I can't remember right now. James Cameron, you know, make Titanic. He made Avatar, you know. Spielberg, he still throws his hat in the ring every few years. But he's kind of from the old guard a bit. But you do not have filmmakers getting a lot of notice for being different and creative and doing their own thing. Unlike back maybe in the 70s and 80s when that was the way you succeeded was by doing something different and doing it well and finding a unique thing to do and not just doing a fifth installment of some sort of series or something. And so that's where we are. So it was refreshing for me to see that the great Wes Anderson had a new movie coming out, Moonrise Kingdom. Now, if you're going to the Hulk 4, if you're anxiously anticipating the new, yet again, Spider-Man thing, or reveling in the new Batman that's been redone a million times, I know it's good movie and stuff like that, but good grief, it's not a new concept or idea. You're thinking, Wes Anderson, huh, Phil? What are you talking about? Gee whiz. Hey, if you've never seen one of my favorite movies of all time, maybe my favorite, it's, of course, Rushmore, made by Wes Anderson. Quirky, fun, intelligent filmmaker from Dallas, where I grew up. I had a loose connection with Luke and Owen Wilson growing up. They were from North Dallas. Luke Wilson, you'll remember him from, you know, he was Richie in the Royal Tenenbaums with the headband. Luke was also in Old School. He was the guy, the main guy in Old School. Luke and I went to preschool together. So I just remembered Luke Wilson from preschool. We went to different grade schools, but it was still something we'd run into each other at a bar when we were 20 years old or 22, you know, and we'd kind of give a little nod. Oh, hey, you know. But we didn't know each other very well. But they were from Dallas, so I was interested, you know, in these guys' movie careers kind of taking off. Started with Wes Anderson's film Bottle Rocket, which is a great movie, and then followed by Rushmore, which was just a movie I just love, followed by The Royal Tenenbaums. These films are all similar in that they are, God, they're detail. Watch The Royal Tenenbaums with Gene Hackman and Ben Stiller, Owen Wilson, Angelica Houston, Danny Glover, Bill Murray. He's got all these great casts. I mean, actors, like real actors flock to this guy, to Anderson, because he's got funny dialogue. Great visuals. There's a great How They Made It, you know, like a How DVD thing for the Royal Tenenbaums. I own the DVD. And just the detail they put into that house the Tenenbaums lived in and the old drawings that the kids made, and he just made them all and did all this unique stuff. So Anderson is a true artist, man. He makes a film. He doesn't just say, well, I got hired on to make the Brady Bunch 6, you know, or, George Washington Goes to Vietnam or something, or, you know, whatever. It just kind of genre, you know, movie du jour kind of deal. And I know he's directed some commercials, I think, overseas and some stuff like that. But anyway, I'm a fan of his. I haven't been as on board with some of his other movies. A lot of people loved Life Aquatic, which I didn't think was nearly as strong as those first two or three movies. And then the Darjeeling Limited, which I have not seen. So anyway, I see the ads for Moonrise Kingdom. It's just a Wes Anderson movie through and through. Quirky record players and dress and dialogue and weird music, but it's got the big cast. It's got Frances McDormand, Bill Murray, Bruce Willis, Edward Norton, and it's the story of a young khaki scout, you know, a Cub Scout kid, 12 years old, escapes, leaves his camp, Camp Ivanhoe, and goes to find this girl, Susie, who he's been pen-palling with secretly. And they go off on an adventure on an island. I don't know where they filmed this. It must have been up like in Maine, maybe. Like, it could be over there, or it could be over, the coast of Washington State or something like that. But you know, fog, islands, streams, beautiful scenery. And they had this adventure, and they're being tracked down by their parents, by Child Protective Services, by the sheriff, by the scout troop and scoutmaster. They're all looking for these kids. So it's got all the settings for a great Wes Anderson deal of quirky visuals, interesting characters, great dialogue, and it has all that. And maybe the last movie I voluntarily saw in the movie theater, isn't this terrible? Think about this. Was probably the Royal Tenenbaums. I remember that. I saw that when I was living in Nashville. So that was like 2001. Now, I've been in movie theaters a lot since then, but I'm always taking the kids to go see the Smurfs or something on a rainy day. It's always something I'm just kind of like, well, I'm not really into this. But took them to see Diary of a Wimpy Kid. That was a damn good movie. Pretty funny. But that kind of thing. So this was the first time that my wife and I went to see a movie that we really wanted to see. In a long time. I mean, we watch lots of movies on Netflix and stuff like that. Hit the red box, etc. So it's unique, man. Getting into the theater again, watching. Man, it's no day. The movie theater thing for me is just almost gone. This movie started. Wes Anderson movie starts. All the lights are on in there. All the lights are on. I can clearly see everybody fumbling around and getting their seat. I'm like, why are the lights on? Why are the lights on? You know, my wife was like, quiet, just watch the movie. I'm like, it's driving me crazy. So I go down to the lobby. God, I'm turning into such an old man. I'd have never done this in my 20s. So I go down there. I'm like, hey, the lights are on in there. So they turn the lights off. Thank you, you know. So they start the movie, and you just see the glows of the cell phones, people eating popcorn behind me, smacking their food. I'm just like, man, if they're trying to save the movie, it's over. Now, you can put up with this kind of stuff if you're going in there to watch 3D Hulks and stuff like that. If being there is part of the thing, then you put up with that kind of stuff. But if you're trying to watch a movie like Woody Allen made, or some real story-driven, funny, intelligent thing, you don't want to see it in a damn theater, man, in my opinion. So, I don't know what that says for the future of the movie house, man. But I probably won't be there. The experience was that bad. But it was, I was trying to really concentrate on the dialogue and stuff. You got to keep up with these Anderson films. My overall assessment of it is pretty fair. My wife loved it, and I feel bad giving it a slightly mediocre review, because you step back and say, well, okay, Phil, you didn't think it was great. Well, compared to what? What else is out there? You know, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer, Rock of Ages, Avengers. Compared to what? You don't think it's as good as the? It's vastly more intricate and interesting and stuff than any of that stuff. And I totally agree. So it's not fair for Wes Anderson, but I do compare him to his other movies that I love so much. And interestingly enough, man, he started his career with, as we talked about, Owen Wilson. Everybody knows him, you know, the blonde-haired funny guy with the broken nose. Been around forever in all kinds of funny movies, Wedding Crashers, among many, many others. Owen Wilson wrote that first Bottle Rocket movie with Wes Anderson, and it had great humor in it, all the visuals and all that kind of stuff. But it also had a great deal of humanity in it. It was, there were tender moments in that movie. Same can be said for Rushmore, the story of Max Fisher, the private school kid who's really kind of a poor kid, trying to hold on to his, place at Rushmore, falls in love with the older woman. It's hilarious, man, but there's great moments of tenderness. What, you've been laughing the whole movie, and then there's several scenes where the tears well up in your eyes. You can't help but that lump in your throat, in your gut, when you're watching something on screen. Royal Tenenbaums is full of those kinds of moments. And Anderson made those movies with Owen Wilson helping with the writing. And since then, he has written the films with other people. I think among them Roman Coppola, I guess, of the vaunted Francis Ford Coppola family. That's who helped write Moonrise Kingdom. And he had other co-writers on Life Aquatic and other things. But man, it just seems like these recent ones he's done, the last four or five, have just not had, they've had the humor, they've had the visuals, but it's been a little stale. It's just not, there's no emotion in it. There's no humanity in it like those first three films he made. And I wonder, man, if he can, and you know what, his old buddy Owen Wilson's making, well, I don't know, what other silly romantic comedy movies and making money and doing whatever. I don't know if he's still, if they're still really good friends or talk about working together again. But I'd like to see him, Anderson, I think, who's really in charge of all the interesting visuals and all that kind of thing that he's so great at, the details, the direction of it. But maybe give his old buddy Wilson a ring and say, hey, let's work on this next one together. You know, help me write it. Help me have a little, because some of these films, they're just, you're watching it and I like it and I love it because I love what I appreciate the effort that went into it. Their idea that it's an original idea, an original script, that these actors are in it, that all the cool camera angles and details and attention to costumes and stuff like that. I appreciate that, and on its own self, that's at least going to get, you know, 7 out of 10 stars from me. But man, you want those next two stars, man. You want it to really hit you in the gut. You want to really feel it walking out of the theater. And I feel like I could do a little better on that. So, Wes Anderson, you give, geez, how many stars you give? 4 stars? 10? 1 out of 10? I'd say on 1 out of 10, I'd give Rushmore a 9, Tenenbaums an 8. I'd probably give Moonrise Kingdom about a 6.5, somewhere down there. Certainly worth your time. But if you're not a big Wes Anderson fan, I think Moonrise Kingdom will whip your ass a little bit. You'll be kind of like, God, this is just so arty and goofy. It might be a little much to bear. So, if you've seen Rushmore and Tenenbaums and think, not my cup of tea, Phil, then stay away from this one. But if you loved Rushmore, if you love all the aesthetic of Anderson's films, Moonrise Kingdom is up there. I'd say in third or fourth place. So, take that for whatever it's worth. And you know what? Just wait for it to come on in Netflix or DVD or something like that. It'd be more fun to watch it at home rather than in... and man, it was showing in one theater in Fort Worth. You believe that? A big movie? God, Fort Worth. You just got like, you know, whatever the hell, Avengers on like 7 screens, you know, just all day long, round the clock playing. And man, I had to look hard to find Moonrise Kingdom. So Moonrise Kingdom, it's out there. Fun, exhilarating, and exciting. Everything the general public despises about movies, apparently. Well, 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 he was here last week, Roger Ray, talking about life, fishing, playing music, everything, Colorado, etc. Well, he's back here again. So many more topics to cover with him in more detail. Roger Ray will be with us in our next segment. Stay tuned. Sound. Oh, they are distant. They start at the ground. I still remember you were looking up. I poured the wine and then you drank it up. I learned that every song I ever knew held that simple truth. Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast from Trinidad World Recording Studios. Well, 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 who you got for us today, Phil? I'll tell you who we got. A legend in the Texas Red Dirt community, Roger Ray from Jason Boland and the Stragglers, drops by and lends his presence to us on the IKEA sofa here. Welcome back to the show, man.
We're glad to be back.
Talking last week, you know, a little bit about your background, playing steel, learning the ropes, figuring out the mysteries of the steel guitar, meeting Jason Boland up there in Stillwater, Yellow House. Oh man, we could do like a year of shows, I'm sure.
It's legendary
on the
status,
grotesque
man.
And just wild happenings at that place.
We could for sure, but you know we would be incriminating too many. Legends.
That's the hard part. We get into these stories, the gory details. Like, well, maybe I shouldn't say that about this guy, but anyway, he was there. And,
yeah, I've always wanted to kind of write these stories down, but like
right.
I said, I'm thinking now I'm going to have to write some kind of a fiction take on it all, so that I'll have the legend.
Yeah,
which is you know mm-hmm. like. Mike equals Stoney LaRue.
That's right. When people ask you, hey, is that really him? You're kind of like, hey,
yeah, I don't know.
It's fiction.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
What was that book about Bill Clinton, A Primary Colors? Remember
exactly.
that?
Exactly. That was anonymous.
Anonymous.
It was an anonymous, but I guess they
Joe Klein wrote it.
Yeah.
From Newsweek or wherever he's
yeah,
from.
Yeah, yeah. But that didn't come out until years later.
Yeah, right. Who wrote it?
Which makes
stuff.
Me wonder, when the movie came out,
right.
the guy had still not Travolta. Come out.
Is that right?
I'm pretty sure the movie was adapted from the book. Who gets the money?
Anonymous gets it. maybe he had trademarked that name, Anonymous.
Just wondered about that.
You know, it'd be a there'd be a hell of a tell-all on some of this at some point.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who probably thinks they could write it. But it'd take a deft hand to
sure. You'd want to do it.
You know,
in
you don't want to hurt people.
That's right.
Either, but it would be.
I think Rita Ballou does a pretty good job of containing the
Man.
Modern blog.
Well, and people pay attention to what she does.
Yeah, I like her style.
Mm-hmm.
I want to not like it, but
right.
every now and again I'll read it, and just the crafty writing style. And you know, and it's blog and not fiction.
Right. Of course, we're talking about Rita. Is it RitaBallou.com?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's just a it's sort
just
of
kind of a weekly
TMZ for
yeah.
Texas Music Red
exactly.
Dirt kind of thing. Right.
Exactly. With her little
photos
sense of humor.
And, yeah,
and it's funny. I sometimes want to not like it because I think the blogosphere can I'm not saying it does.
Yeah,
can dumb down a scene.
Sure,
very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
If you take something like take the grunge scene in Seattle.
Right.
That scene has a lot of legitimacy.
Right.
But if you had blogs and cartoon strips about it back then, mm-hmm. it almost makes it like for instance Top 40 Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Top 40 Nashville doesn't have to be so dumbed down.
Uh-huh.
They don't have to do that, but they choose to it because sales dictate, hey, it's better to have Taylor Swift sing a poppy song than some old recovering, you know, alcoholic or
but they're just going on
prison
the,
guy.
But they're just looking at the numbers, aren't they?
That's right.
Mr. Accountants, and, you know,
that's
just
what I'm
like,
saying, though.
It's not that
people want happy in a bottle.
Right.
They don't want old prison guy singing
right.
songs about prison anymore.
Because those songs are out there. That
that's
stuff gets released.
That's right.
It just sells 1,000 copies, and Taylor Swift sells 8 million.
That's right. And so to bring that back to the blogging thing, I think that when someone pokes fun at, say, a Randy Rogers or,
right.
or a Casey Donahue or Josh Abbott or
right.
whatever, then it almost makes it a valid mockery.
Right.
If a critic can come out openly and say, this person sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of the people don't know that person might suck until one of their contemporaries say, well, they suck.
Right.
Or whatever it be. You know what I'm saying?
It's unique that, because I do seem like, it does seem like to me that in the Texas Music Red Dirt deal, it is so cozy. And I feel like up until recently, there wasn't enough teeth in some of the writing and the blogs because everybody's friends. These guys who run these
sure.
websites, they're buddies with all these
sure.
guys and
sure.
they want to see them do well. And if they didn't think the new Randy Rogers is very good, they probably wouldn't say so.
Right on.
And so it's kind of refreshing to see the Rita Ballou.
It is.
She'll sink their teeth into someone's new record, and I'm kind of like, wow, you know? Like,
right.
Ouch. Like, you don't see. Now, guys outside the Texas
right,
music.
I see what you're saying.
Guys outside the Texas music scene would freely skewer Pat Green or whoever.
Like, absolutely.
Not it's just him, but the whole genre. It's Texas
that's
music.
Right, that's right.
But in the genre, the websites and stuff are usually very. It's just a picture with the guy. He's got this record and he's great. So it's refreshing to see. I don't know, some of her takes on some things.
It is me too. But it's a fine line, is what I'm
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, it is.
If everybody starts becoming. I don't know. You can't be a critic. I guess what I'm saying is what you were saying. If if you don't like someone in the genre, you probably don't like the entire genre.
Right,
and I
right.
think it's okay to slam the entire Texas Red Dirt scene, if that be your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But to pick and choose within the genre some of what I would deem all similar artists with similar messages and similar bands even,
right.
similar sounds, mm-hmm. is almost saying, well, I'm going to pick on this person because I don't like them and they were mean to me once.
Yeah, yeah.
It has nothing to do with the merit of what they might or might not be doing artistically.
Right.
But I think we get a lot of that in our scene. People feel the need to know the artist mm-hmm. and not just take it for face value. Like, this mm-hmm. is their work, and I'm going to listen to their work.
Right.
You hear it a lot. Well, you know, I like so-and-so, but he's an asshole.
Yeah, right.
what difference does that make about the songs that person's singing or uh-huh. what they're writing?
Well, I think that goes back to just how cozy it all is.
Yeah. It's
No one just makes a record and hides out somewhere, and you don't see them till they're gigged.
You can't.
Yeah,
because if you do that, you get beat by the marketing prowess, which is this scene, which is whoever hangs out the longest at the end of the night sells more records.
All right, now you're getting into my territory, as a self-proclaimed hermit in some ways, and a guy that's not out there very much. My question is this: to that point. Because that's what it is. Hey, man, you got to hang out with everybody and all that. It's true. It's no doubt that seems to be the case. My question is, years ago, wasn't it truer that maybe if you had some element of mystery, if you maybe weren't as approachable?
Years ago, sure.
Wouldn't that entice interest a bit?
I think,
you
in
know,
other
like
genres even.
We didn't know what Led Zeppelin looked like.
That's right.
We didn't know, you know.
I still don't know what Pink Floyd looks like.
No one knows. How many guys are in the band? I have no idea. Well, you know what I mean? That was a big part of rock and roll.
Sure it was.
Maybe not country as much. I think country.
Even country, though. Even back in the day, it was a part of it, I think.
A lot of mystery, yeah.
Well, you know, you didn't have to know what, say, Waylon Jennings looked like.
Right.
Because his songs kind of spoke what he looked like.
That's right.
You kind of knew what Johnny Cash looked like because of that deep voice. That was
right.
his appearance was that voice.
Right. I guess my question, and I'm just asking myself this out loud as a guy who's out there making music, is you're pushed and spurred by people so long. I mean, you've got to be tweeting, you've got to be on Facebook, you've got to be in people's face, you've got to hang out,
right.
you got to take pictures. And at some point, it's hard to determine what the effect of that is, what the overall value of that is. And sometimes you toy with the idea of just, man, what if I was just obscure? What if I didn't
sure.
ever talk to anybody?
Right.
Would there be, or, you know, would it just vanish off the map? Or would there be some intrigue then
I think the
fostered? Or, you know, you're kind of like, man, he doesn't talk to anybody. I mean, we talk about tweeting and stuff, but, you know, Dylan doesn't.
But he's grandfathered in.
He's grandfathered in. But Steve Jobs, you know, he was famous. He just didn't give interviews, you know. So who was the one guy everybody was interested in what he thought? It was him,
right,
you know.
Now Steve Jobs.
Now he's successful and
arguably
and
not an artist.
Right.
You know, I mean.
Oh, but you'd call him an artist, wouldn't you?
You would.
Created these things.
Sure, but not in the classic context.
Okay. Well.
My point is that. While I want you to be right, you're probably wrong.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? If
yeah.
you're not, if you don't have a Facebook presence and a Twitter presence, you're getting beat by someone that does.
Right.
And it speaks volumes about not the artist, but the audience.
Mm-hmm.
The audience demands that.
Right.
But they don't want
that
just
interaction.
The record. They demand it. And if
right.
you don't deliver that, then you're no longer a viable artist for their pocketbook.
John Mayer couldn't hide for a year and then just release a record and everybody's going to go buy it.
That's right.
They want to know his thoughts on breakfast cereal.
That's right.
In the meantime.
Boxers or briefs.
That's
whatever.
Right.
I mean, it's even happening in politics. The politician
yeah.
with the best platform doesn't win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, It's amazing to see what campaign dollars go to versus
mm-hmm.
what they used to go to.
Right.
You know, now it's all about presence, media presence.
Sure.
And so I think, and this can go into this classic argument that we
okay,
were talking
yeah,
about.
Okay, this is kind of our topic. Okay, lead us in there.
I think that the media presence
mm-hmm.
dictating who does and doesn't get to be the artist of the year or
mm-hmm.
whatever has dumbed down our art, for art's sake. Let's say there's a polarity between art and entertainment.
God,
the more you entertain...
All right, let me just say right here, Roger Ray, he's already just the most philosophical guy who's ever been on this show. without contest.
Well, thank you.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm just throwing that in there.
But let me,
an observation.
Let me put this question to you.
Okay.
Are you an artist or an entertainer?
I would call myself an entertainer.
Okay. But there's going to be, like, say the pie is 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has their, I mean, I think Boland is more, at least he would label himself more like 80% artist, 20%
sure,
entertainer.
Sure, right. Some
and everybody has
everybody
their
would
thing.
Say that, probably.
We live in a day when I think the pie has become about entertainment and less mm-hmm. about art. Where yeah. I think years and years ago, especially before the advent of the media as we know it, especially mm-hmm. especially social media, it used to be people demanded a lot more art in their pie, in their entertainment.
Right.
You know, movies. Look at movies from the 40s and 50s opposed to what we have now, like these CGI blockbusters are nothing. There's no plot. It's formulaic.
Yeah.
It's basically South Park, 2 hours long, with yeah. CGI.
Right. Right.
And I say that, and as I'm
it's
saying
not
it,
the
I
Godfather,
think...
The Godfather, you know. It, yeah. Yeah.
As it's coming out my mouth, I'm thinking, man, that's a good movie.
You're right.
Right. Man, a CGI South
well,
Park.
Well, this leads into a comment you made. I forget whose record you were here doing. I guess it was with Drew Womack and those guys back here. That record we... Oh, you yeah. weren't here when he was here, but...
Yeah.
Savage. Seth Savage's record we've been working on, doing some steel. And you just kind of offhanded... Made the comment, I can't remember if it was about guitars or cars or what. You go, man.
You started with cars.
You said, and I quote, you go, nothing's classic anymore.
Well,
nothing's classic
anymore. I think that's what I said.
And this led from, I think, me observing that in high school, 80, when I was, you know, 88, 89, whenever I was in high school, a friend of mine drove a 65 Mustang.
There you go.
And you think, man, that car was 20 years old, 22 years old. At that time,
sure,
and I
classic,
go, man, you
no
don't see any more 65 Mustangs, and then you think, well, no kidding, Phil. That now that car is 50 years old.
That's right.
So you think, well, that stands to reason. So here we are, 2012. So is there?
Sure.
Is a 1992 Honda Accord?
That's right.
Classic.
That's
you're kind of like, well, no. Are there any cars from 92 that are going to be like the 65?
There might have been from the early 90s. Even there were still remnants of some muscle cars, weren't there? I guess after the gas shortage in the 80s, there weren't much that was classic. Maybe the Corvette from the early 90s might still be considered.
It just
classic.
Seems like guitars, cars, sure. music in the 60s were built to last. You know, I had that old. Chet Atkins Tennessee and Gretsch with the cedar case. I told everybody, I go, man, this thing, the latches still worked. It was made out of wood. You know, now we get a guitar case, it lasts a couple of years, and you got to throw it in the trash. Everything was just built to last. Quality was king, from cars to anything. You wouldn't make it otherwise. And now, is that not the case? I mean, are there guitars?
There might be.
Yeah,
but,
you know.
But they're not. They're one-offs. They're made by custom shops or whatever.
Yeah, right.
But
some dude. Making one. So what do we take away from that argument? There's nothing as classic anymore.
I don't know. Somewhere form and function changed where, like, what is going to be a classic? What car, what 2012 car is going to be a classic?
Yeah.
What
just the Hyundai
what
Sonata,
song,
you know.
Even better, what art, what songs from today's top 40 will be classics?
Or not even top 40, just from today.
Sure.
I can't tell you how many. I mean, you look back at the Grammys, or I'm just to use as a with a painting with a broad brush, but you know, in the last 10 years, these bands do emerge, and you think, man, here's this new band, cool, and then a couple years later, you just come, what happened to those guys? You know,
right.
And they were, you know, just nothing. They didn't last. You know,
why is that? Let's take a guy like Buddy Holly.
Uh-huh.
Died way too young.
Right.
Take a song.
22,
like,
right?
Something like that.
Yeah, he was younger than people even think. I think that's right.
All right, Peggy Sue. Now, who would argue that's a great written song? Some would, and you know,
right.
It's subjective.
All right.
Pretty.
Yeah.
Pretty Peggy Sue.
But for the time, it was...
Four pretties.
Right.
Like, he could have said anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty, lovely, sure. Whatever. I'm going to go with Four Pretties.
Okay.
So that's a... When you have to agree, Peggy Sue's a classic song.
No question.
Okay. What... If you did a Peggy Sue today, it would be Justin Bieber doing a song of about the same Shallow Substance.
Sure.
And it just doesn't have a classic value.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Why is a pop song from today not going to be listened to 50 years from now, where Peggy Sue is still played on the radio?
I would argue maybe that there's some scarcity, the laws of scarcity. There just wasn't as many acts back then. You know, you had 12 subscriptions of Rolling Stone a year. I use this example sometimes. In the 70s, 80s, 90s, if you were one of those guys on the cover, man, you were Mick Jagger, you were Tom Petty,
sure,
you were Eric Clapton. Man, you were selling out the Cotton Bowl. It meant something to be there. And now there's just so many bands. Everyone's got a record. Who cares? Arcade Fire's on the cover, the White Stripes. All very good bands, but where are they playing? They're playing where Bolin's playing. You know, they're playing the Granada Theater.
Sure.
They're playing the House of Blues. They're not selling out soccer stadiums. There's more scarcity. So maybe there's just such a glut of product out there.
What? No,
that maybe it has a hard time for any. The focus is lost. There's no cultural center. When the Beatles won, Ed Sullivan, just every person in the world saw it. What do
right.
you mean? I mean, every set of eyeballs watched it. Now, some bands on Saturday Night Live, who cares?
Sure, but there are still those moments where, you know, the Super Bowl. Who was on the Super Bowl this year?
I don't know. Madonna?
Wasn't it Madonna?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Well, there you go. So every set of eyes saw Madonna, say, at the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So you still have those icons that are that big.
But it doesn't translate. She wasn't on there, and her sales just jumped the next day. Everybody just shrugged and went on in the second half.
Did it wasn't they? I don't know.
She might have seen peaked, but it wasn't a cultural event, was it?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I don't know. You gotta have all eyeballs focused, man.
Were those events cultural in the moment, or are we just romanticizing those moments? Like when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan,
yeah,
were those, if you were there in the moment,
dude,
was it cultural?
They went.
I mean, obviously Woodstock was cultural even in the moment.
Sure.
People in the moment knew this is something big.
This is something.
As it's happening, they know they're making history. Now,
that's
what
right.
concert is that way now?
Man, I don't know. I really don't know.
There isn't one.
What are we debating here? How confused we are? That's all. That's all I'm gathering from what I'm saying.
I think that we're pointing out the obvious, but nobody knows why.
Well, I've even had this experience in my own career, and maybe y'all have as well. That. You know, you look back maybe 4 or 5 years and think of some shows you're playing and think, man, something was kind of going on there. You know, we had every college kid in the state coming to these festivals, but then everybody kind of grew up. It seems like man, that was kind of a passing time. That's
sure.
not here anymore, you know.
Yeah,
we all got older, and I don't know. I didn't realize we had it good right then. It's kind of like when your stock's at 100, now it goes to 40, and you look back and go, well hell, I should have sold it.
Well,
you know, it just
how do you know
you
then?
Don't realize you're at a peak until it's over.
Well,
I don't know.
So do you not realize that you're at a peak right now, Phil? Right now you're having a peak.
I'm in the valley.
You're
right
not
now.
Savoring the moment. 20 years from now, you'll think, remember that time we did that radio thing? Man, we were in the prime of our youth.
At the apex, man. That's right. Well, you do think of those times like, man, we just signed our Bud deal and went off and played this festival.
Sure. No, I do.
And then played at Green Hall all like one day. You know, what a day that was. Like, how many have we had since? And you're kind of like, I don't know. Like, just, and you look back and kind of, man, our whole thing kind of built to that.
Sure.
You can't say that day, but just somewhere around then. And then the bass player got married and the drummer quit, and you know, we're all just
it's
back.
It's the law of diminishing returns, though. The first burger is much better than the eighth burger.
Yeah.
Right?
So how do you reconcile that? You know Pete Coatney from Jack Ingram's band. He's been on the show many times, a podcast favorite. And yeah, our topics often turn to that. Yeah, people come up to guys like you and me. Man, you're lucky you get to do what you love for a living, man. You know, I'm working the day job. You're doing what you love. And we all know that and cherish that, but you know, are there times where you think, man, I don't know if I can do this anymore. I don't know if, you know, what's the point
in
going back to this place? You know,
sure.
It's the same gig. It's the same people, only not as many. Maybe it's just well, you know. I mean,
I totally know what you're saying.
How do you? You're a musician. How do you keep it going?
Valium.
Yeah.
No. I know what you're saying.
At first, I thought you said volume. Like, oh, he does it a lot. No, Valium. No, Valium. Okay,
my Valium goes to 12.
There we go. Do you have those moments where you just...
Oh, man.
You go, I don't know if I can load in the back door of this place again. I don't know if I can do it.
I don't really have those moments. I'll tell you what I have, though, that is very similar, is I get this grass is greener syndrome. Like, this is cool, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Sure.
But, man, I wish I had another life where I could do this right now.
Like and, what?
Oh, I mean...
Accounting, fishing?
Fly fishing guide,
yeah,
maybe.
Right.
I mean, just anything. Or another... be in three different bands at one... I mean,
another adventure.
Another
somewhere.
Adventure, that's right, right. So that you're eating the first burger again in something different.
I see, yeah, yeah.
But like I said, I don't... I definitely value doing this instead of being out in the hot sun doing construction every day.
Sure.
Nothing against construction, but I'm glad I don't have to do it. I'm very blessed to not have to do manual labor 50 hours a week.
That's right.
But, you know, anything can become manual labor if you lose interest in it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's the battle because, you know, the hard thing for me, and I've shared this on the show a few times, you just early on... You walk into the wherever, Green Hall, the firehouse, or somewhere for the first time. Your record's coming out, and man, you have such high hopes. You think, man, this is a step. You know, this is a significant. We need to make this count. And get people out. So we're gonna hit radio. We're here. Let's make the most of it. And at some point, you just kind of come over the hill and you know, you look at the schedule and we're going here and you just kind of shrug your shoulders and you hope it doesn't rain. You hope people show up. Well, you know, you don't pin any, you don't just go through that door of the firehouse with the same, it's nothing you don't like to play.
That's right.
But you're not pinning any future hope. You're reading no significance into whether,
contemplate slitting
my
wrist.
I
know what you're saying.
I used to be on cloud nine if it was 500 people, and I used to crawl back to the van if it was 10 people. And now, you'd rather have 500, but you just know that it could be either one, and you're just not going to let yourself get too upset about one or the other.
Right.
Or too high or too low. Man, then we're going to be back in 2 months, and who cares?
On the one hand,
you get into this.
That's great for self-therapy on the one hand.
I don't know if that's professional or what.
On the other hand, people feel the energy when you're excited about being there.
Yeah, sure.
And so if you've already displaced that energy and thought, you know, I'm not going to expend that energy because why get myself up into a situation of high expectations when 10 people show up? Screw that. I'm just going to go play my show, put a blindfold on, and then go back to the
band. I'm not saying we do that.
I'm not saying that you do either, but I'm saying that's the direction.
That's the trouble. That's the problem. That's when you can't do it. Your job every night is to get there, to play that song you've played 500 times and play the solo different. And, man, I kind of changed the phrasing on the last verse and just kind of make yourself like, hey, that was kind of cool.
Right, And it's to challenge yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
Excitement to your game, basically.
Well, here's a question along those lines before we have to leave here, because I've discussed this, and your name has come up, and I don't know if I can hang in this type of a deal. But that vinyl, the rack of vinyl records over here, Philip Rich and the Full Band, it's filled with albums where guys, the story of the record is just some guys went in a room not knowing what they were going to do, and they just did all this stuff, and here it is, and that's it. And here we are still talking about it. It's over there.
Right.
And I wonder if that's possible in our pop, in the pop environment. People say, we can't do that now. You got to have a single. It's all about this and that and this. But the fact is, no one really does it. And you know, me and Pete had talked about, I said, man, what if we got like Roger, me, you know, Jeremy Plato, and Coatney on drums, and Bucca Allen. And we just kind of showed up, and everybody had their instruments, and just some real loose arrangements on some standard country stuff.
Sure,
and
man.
We did some jazz stuff. And just, you know, like that album Super Session, that's Stephen Stills. And it's just, it's just this total... I don't know, and you just release some record, but is that what anybody in this field looks for or anything?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Maybe it would suck anyway.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because...
You know, I'm just kind of like, would anyone be interested in it? And then you kind of think, why would they be? I don't know. We're just. But then you look back and they used to. You know, I don't know.
Whenever I leave the house, I typically will grab a CD and listen to it on wherever I'm going. Well, the other day I grabbed just off the middle of the stack there, it happened to be Van Morrison's TB Sheets. You know, mm-hmm. familiar with this record?
No, uh-uh. I know Van Morrison a lot.
TB Sheets is a record. I don't know for sure, but it sounds like tuberculosis sheets. Right? So because there's a song that mentions...
was this like later 70s?
I'm not even sure the year.
Okay.
But it's definitely a session you can tell from listening where they just were in a room and in came Van Morrison and they played their songs.
Yeah.
And then they took the ones that they thought were full band cuts that were good enough to put on the record, and they did.
Yeah.
Oh, and let's throw Brown Eyed Girl on there.
Right, right.
So, but you listen to it, and the first time through, I'm just driving on the road thinking, man, there were bad notes. There were clunkers.
You're
talking in the
all
background.
All Van Morrison's records are like that.
And I just thought, man, this kind of sucks. Because I'm not trained to listen to this anymore.
That's right.
But then I thought, wait a minute, this is kind of cool too.
Right.
But I don't think average quality purchaser, consumer of that which is art and entertainment today, likes that anymore.
Yeah.
I think that's passé.
But how do we know? Is it... Have they not been presented with it, or are they being presented and they're passing
and
it
then, and then you got like Cross Canadian Ragweed's live record, Live and Loud, or the Wormy Dog.
Uh-huh.
And that's a huge seller, and that sonically is not very good sonically. Yeah. You know, there's hissing
just
and
a
pops.
Crap record.
It's kind of a low budget. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I do.
And I'd say that about my best-selling
people
stuff,
love that
live
record.
Stuff.
People
you know,
love that record.
Right.
I don't even know that I haven't even talked to the guys about that record. I wonder if Cody Canada loves that record.
I'm sure he does.
I don't know whether he likes it or not at this point in his life, but the fact is, that record is sonically poor.
Yeah.
I think they made the whole thing for $3,000 or $4,000.
Yeah.
But that is some people's favorite Ragweed record.
No doubt about it.
You know, Live at Billy Bob's, our record, uh-huh. Bowen.
Yeah.
That,
it's probably your bestseller, one of them.
Probably one of the bestsellers, but not the most sonically... you know, not the most sonic quality record.
I've made 3 live albums. They're my 1, 2, and 3 bestsellers out of 14 albums. Whatever we
there
got.
You go. There you go.
People like in this genre anyway have proven. Maybe you do the jam thing. Maybe you do it live.
There you go.
Maybe we rehearse.
Oh man, that's even the better idea.
A little, and we go to the surf club.
You don't even rehearse it.
It's one.
I say
okay,
you just don't even rehearse it. Otherwise, you're already hamming it up to be something that's not. You just show up.
I just think it'd be exciting. You'd have to have some guys, despite any technical all limitations I have. There's some things I can do, and I've just played so many shows now with bass players or drummers who've never even heard my stuff. Where I just go, hey man, just watch my right foot, and you know, and we get through the show. But sometimes those shows are really thrilling if you got a guy who's
sure.
They say, man, he's never heard of you, but he's a fantastic drummer. Those shows for me playing are very exciting,
right?
Because we're just gonna plow through the breaks. We're not gonna do it, you know. And I just kind of wait to see what he does, and we just go off somewhere. And man, even in a Texas music audience that's used to singles, people starts to draw people in. But then we got to stop and play one of them that everybody knows. And
sure,
I find myself going, damn, I wish we could have just done that for like 2 hours. That'd have been
because it's
you know what I mean.
It
I don't
goes
know.
Back to that energy. I think mm-hmm. that nervousness. When you're feeling that, where are we going on this journey? For
and
the
audience
first time
can
ever?
See the band looking at each other and
that's
waving
right.
and just screaming in the guy's ear and
that's it, right.
I don't know. I'd like to do something to where that could really happen, and I don't know. You have to get the right people together and the right venue to do it. But I hadn't thought about it. I thought about doing the studio, but that would just be two people.
Oh man,
going,
alive,
people go, man,
unrehearsed.
We got to do that again and stuff. Or maybe you could just have some, maybe you could go back here. You do something on your website or something. You say, look, man, we got 25 tickets. I don't know. You do a contest.
Well, you know,
charge.
The Steamboat kind of has
people,
that.
Where people are sitting around on the floor, you've got your instrument, and there's just people, sitting there with a beer or something, on the floor. And you're just – it's you and everybody's just – I don't know. You just try to have a musical conversation.
Yeah. Up in Steamboat, they'll do a jam. Mm-hmm. And some years – depending on what time each band's playing, some years I've got to participate in it and some years I haven't.
Right.
But I always try to go by there and just see a song or two because the bands will always be a hodgepodge.
Right.
It might be Stoney and, Randy Rogers guitar player
right.
or you know, somebody else's drummer and whatever. And so you've got this hodgepodge of guys up there from various bands doing a seven-piece wonder band, and they pick some cover song, like The Weight or something.
Right, right.
And it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's awesome because it's genuinely, it's genuine music.
And everybody's just having fun.
Yeah, and it's just great.
And it comes across. Well, man, we'll have to put together our supergroup at some point.
And then the other question is, would they be original songs?
It could be, yeah.
It would almost have to be, right?
It would. I think you just come up with some little vampy, just you just center it around one little thing that works, and then we're going to go to here, and then we'll go back to it. And
sure.
I don't know if there's – yeah, it wouldn't necessarily have to have –
There's a guy up in Denton. Was Paul Slavens. Is that
yeah,
his name?
Oh yeah, he's an old school dude.
Yeah. Who does the four napkins and he gets all the
like. What does he do?
He used to do this thing on Monday night at Dan's.
Was he Tin Hands when he in that band?
I don't know.
He's old Dallas.
Yeah, Dallas radio GM NPR guy. Right. Yeah. Well, he would do a thing where you'd submit three or four things. Like three, he would take napkins. You'd submit a lyric.
Oh,
it could
I
be
see.
The most quirkiest thing. He'd take three or four of them and he'd read them and he'd make a song immediately on the spot.
That's
improv,
cool, yeah.
Of the four things, it could be something like that.
Yeah, that
maybe
is.
Not so
that
hokey, is. But something like that.
Man, yeah, you have people submit
ideas. You actually
ideas.
Write the songs on the spot.
Yeah, no, I think something like that would be exciting because, like all music, the Texas music thing, it does get tiring when it's just it is the same producers and the same people and the same kind of. Sound and the chorus, and you're floating down the river, and it's just, you know, I don't know.
Sure.
And you can make an argument that that's what people want to hear. That's cool, but just kind of let's make a project that people don't want to hear, maybe, but have fun with it. You know, you don't have to just spend years mixing it away. You just do it and you upload it to iTunes.
Man, I love
and you just say, and you just, hey man, from the first download, we all make a dollar. You know, just we didn't spend any
or whatever
money.
Yes.
Yeah, you just kind of go, I don't know. It's not something we all need to.
First of all, it wouldn't be a big production nor cost that much, but it would be a fun kind of organic thing.
Yeah.
I used to be, and still kind of am, a big fan of Golden Smog, which was a collaboration between
Jeff Tweedy.
Tweedy and then the Jayhawks, right? A couple of guys from the Jayhawks.
Yeah, man. Gary Loris.
That's right. Now, why doesn't anybody do stuff like that anymore?
Well, you know, I had an idea for a band like that. We were going to get Alex Whedon from Miranda.
Mm-hmm.
He was with Honey Brown for a long time.
Right.
It was myself and Cody and... Plato and my old drummer Jason Stolle. It was gonna be Cross. What was it gonna be? Poly Canadian Phil Whedon or something like that.
Oh, right on.
You know, years ago, never came to be.
Sure.
Unfortunately,
sure.
The world is the poorer for it.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, man, let's put some more thought to this, man. I'd love to get some kind of just some weird group of folks together and Yeah, just do some. I think you come up with a lot of things people hadn't heard. You just 9-minute versions of tunes and just
yeah, man.
You know what I mean?
I'd
just
be way in
like,
on something.
Man, you know
that.
That'd be just a. We recorded that at 3 a.m. You know, we're all just there and
yeah,
listen to
fun.
The next day and say, man, this is great. Let's just put it out there. Well, Roger Ray here. Gosh, man, we're just going off the deep end here. Trying to figure out our artistic lives, where it might be going. Looking for that new adventure in an era where nothing is classic anymore. Trying to make. Something classic in an era where nothing is classic anymore. But that's what we're all trying to do, right?
That's it. That's the goal. I guess. I don't know. We're all. That's a big blanket statement.
That's right.
That's what we're trying to do.
That's what you're trying to do.
That's what a lot of people that I know are trying to do. But I do know some people that are only trying to sell records.
Yeah.
I do not fault them for it.
That's right.
But because most of them make no bones about it. They say, look, I don't know what you're trying
to
do.
They think that's what they're trying to do. Right.
I'm trying to sell a bunch of records, and that's great.
Right.
But almost, at least from my opinion, when someone's goal is to sell more records, generally speaking, I find it way less artistic.
Sure. Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
It's usually going to, in my opinion, suck.
Yeah. Well, Roger Ray is here. Again, folks. Maybe you'll stop by next week for a little fishing talk. I know he's an avid fisherman. Well, folks, that's all the time we have this week on the P2 Podcast. Email me, phil@philpritchard.com. Come record at the studio. Hell, you can have Roger Ray play pedal steel on your project. Guitar, dobro, what have you, man. We'll sit here and make a record for you at Trinidad. Or shoot me an email and let me know about your party and whatever else is going on, festival, etc. The full band will come play for you. We love it, man. Be good to each other out there. We'll see you next week, folks. Much tougher.